Our text for today, Acts chapter 12, verses 12 through 25. We are halfway through the story of the Apostle Peter and his imprisonment and his release from imprisonment. The chapter began with the martyrdom of the Apostle James at the hand of Herod Agrippa I. And when that act made a hero out of Herod in the eyes of the unbelieving Jews there in Jerusalem, he decided to try to one-up that and set his sights on the church's top guy, the Apostle Peter. He arrested him. He made that imprisonment as secure as he possibly could. But then, of course, God got involved, and we come to find out that Herod's best efforts were just not nearly good enough, not even in the ballpark. So the Apostle Peter is now a freed man. An angel of the Lord has set him free, led him out of prison, led him out of the city, and dropped him off at the first street that they came to. He gave Peter no further instructions without so much as a good luck or a goodbye. Off he goes, and now Simon Peter is left there to himself, and he knows where to go. He's going to the church. I just like that. You know, in those big, big life moments, I love it when the first response of the people is to tell the church people, to get together with the church and talk it over. And he knows where the church would be meeting at this point. So one of the biggest questions that should have emerged in your mind from last week's message would be, why did God deliver the Apostle Peter from certain execution and not James the Apostle? Why did the Lord do that? What does that teach us? That the Lord allowed the Apostle James to be martyred for his faith. But then when it was Simon Peter's turn, the Lord spared Simon Peter. So that leaves us with a lot of questions. What does it teach us? Well, it's a truth that many Christians struggle with. It is the truth about God's sovereignty. That's what it teaches us. That God is fully in control of each and every one of our lives and ministries. He knows when one life and one ministry has run its course, and he knows when another is unfulfilled and incomplete. He handles every situation differently because he is working in every one of our lives differently. And that's why Paul tried to get us not to think about comparing ourselves among ourselves. When we start comparing our experience with the experiences of another church person, that can either be very encouraging, if they had it worse than I do, or that can be very discouraging if, man, nothing bad ever happens to that person, and here I am really going through it. So the Lord is working differently in each and every one of our lives, so we can't expect the same thing in every situation. We can't always expect the Lord to deliver us from problems. Sometimes he leads us right into them for his purposes. This chapter really offers us up none of the whys of God's sovereignty, just the stated facts of God's sovereignty. None of the whys. Why did God do this here? And in a very similar situation, days later, the Lord did something completely different. The Lord doesn't offer up those explanations of whys. And he never does in the Bible, ever. It's what the book of Job is all about. It's to teach us about the sovereignty of God and let us know that the Lord never does explain the whys of his sovereignty. Why does he do this here? Why does he do another thing here? He's never going to explain those to us. And as the book of Job teaches us, there are much better questions for our minds and our hearts to be fixated on. That whole book is arguments about, Job, why are you in the situation you're in? And you recall the arguments of his friends. Well, Job, what sin did you commit? How bad must it have been for the Lord to unleash all of this on you? And that wasn't the case. It wasn't Job's sin. That's not why. And when the Lord finally got Job to himself, the Lord gave him those better questions to focus on. Not, Lord, why did you allow this? Why did you do this? What were your purposes? How's this going to look 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road for me? But better questions like this: Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Job, was it you that the angels were singing about when I was busy creating? Job, was it you that established the boundaries of the ocean's tides? Was that you? And the only thing Job could answer was no. And I get it now. You're God, you're sovereign, I'm not. The truth is, if the Lord explained all the whys to us at every difficulty that we faced and came through, we wouldn't understand it anyway. Those kind of questions aren't for this life. We have an eternity to get those questions answered when we're before the Lord in heaven, because then we're going to be capable of understanding the whys of God's sovereignty. We can't right now. And that should be okay with us. That should make sense, because if God was, as the old saying goes, I believe it was C.S. Lewis, if God was small enough for me to understand, he wouldn't be big enough for me to worship. If God's thinking was just like mine and everything God did reasoned out perfectly with my mind, I might question God because I know the weakness of my mind. But I have to understand, and you have to understand, we have to understand as a church, that when it comes to God's sovereignty, we can't understand the whys in these earthly bodies. Here's what we can do, though. We can trust. We can trust the Lord. So that's one of the great lessons of the chapter. I know maybe you were hoping for all of the whys and the intricacies of how God and why God. And if you just walk away with this, God is in control and nothing can happen to me unless it gets his approval, then you're going to be a better Christian for it. Those are the kind of things that the early church had to wrestle with in this chapter, the events of this chapter. So let's finish up this story today, resuming at verse 12, reading verse 12. When he realized this, and again, just back up one verse for the context. When Peter realized that this was actually happening, it wasn't a dream, it wasn't a vision, this was actually happening, the Lord actually delivered him miraculously from this Roman prison. And when he realized that, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark. So that is the human author of the Gospel of Mark. And it is at his mother Mary's house where many were gathered together and were praying. What were they praying about? We were told early in the chapter they were praying for Peter. They were praying about Peter's arrest. So there they are, still praying about this, and for sure some time has passed. We were told that Peter was arrested during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I told you last week that is a seven-day-long celebration. We don't know at what point Peter was arrested during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. If he was arrested early on in that feast, that meant that the church could have been at this for as long as a week, praying for Peter, praying for his deliverance. They've been at this for quite some time, no doubt. And the fact that the early church hasn't skipped town at this point really does show us tremendous courage. I mean, it took bravery for them to meet. Because when Stephen was killed, the church, by and large, emptied out of the town of Jerusalem. They all went their separate ways. They scattered, they dispersed. But I'll tell you, the believers that stayed behind in Jerusalem, this is a different breed. They stayed behind when Stephen was killed. They've been there for years. James is now executed, martyred for his faith. Peter's life was on the line. He was next up in the morning. And yet here they still are. Nothing discouraging them or hindering them from still meeting together. They didn't have the option to catch this on the live stream. You know, like, well, prayer service tonight sounds a little dangerous. Herod is gathering up church folk and sentencing them to execute. Maybe I just catch this one on the live stream. No, they didn't have that option. Church was illegal for them, and yet there they are. They're in church. They're gathered together. I have to ask, if church became illegal, what would you do? Would you catch the live streams? Because I got to tell you, they can trace your IP addresses. They can monitor your online activity. You're actually making it easier for them. They can sit from a computer at home and find out you're watching the Anchored Fellowship service. So probably best just to do the honorable thing. And if church is illegal, just show up anyway. Go out with style. Go out with a testimony for the Lord. The world might say we can't do this. The Lord wants us to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to meet together. That way, your tombstone won't have to read, "He caught the live stream, but they caught him anyway." Nope. Just show up. Show up for duty. Show up for church. Be gathered together with other believers. Verse 13. And when he, Peter, knocked at the door of the gateway of the courtyard to Mary's house there, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Quick note, Mark's mother Mary, one of the many Marys that we read about in the scriptures, was clearly a woman of means. You can get that all from this verse. She has a big enough house that it became a regular meeting spot for the church. She has a gated courtyard, and she's wealthy enough to have a servant girl named Rhoda. So she's a wealthy person. The name Rhoda means rose, and she does come out smelling like a rose after this chapter's end, because even though the rest of the church doesn't believe what she's saying, she never backs down. She believes, she understands what the Lord has done here, and the Lord gives her the privilege of recording her name in the scriptures, which isn't always a given thing, especially among servants. Usually the Bible would just tell you a servant and the servant, but the Lord honors her in this chapter by naming her for us. Now, keep in mind, this is an illegal meeting that is happening inside Mary's house. They all could face execution simply by attending this meeting. And my guess would be that they sent the servant girl Rhoda out to answer the door in order to keep appearances. If you send the servant out to answer the gate of the courtyard, that's what a Roman official would expect. So if a Roman official is there at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, whenever this is happening, that would look normal. But if there's a Roman official knocking out there at the gate and 50 people come out into the courtyard to see who's knocking at the gate, that could raise some suspicions. What's going on in this place? You guys aren't having church, are you? You're not teaching about Jesus. You're not praying to Jesus, are you? So I think a lot of this is simply to keep up the appearance sake of this. It's not because they're making Rhoda the sacrificial lamb. That could be the Romans. Who can we spare? Rhoda, servant girl. She's on the bottom of the totem pole. Send her out. If they take her, that's a minor loss for the church. No, I think it's simply to make this look as legitimate as they can make it and not raise concerns. Verse 14, recognizing Peter's voice, so she doesn't see Simon Peter, with her eyes. She only hears his voice. Vocal recognition, she knows it's Simon Peter. Evidently, this gate was solid. I would guess solid wood, not something you could see through. You'd have to open the gate to see who was out there. So she does not see him, but she hears him. And reading on, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. I love this story. Can you believe this story? As if it couldn't get any more bizarre, it just did. You have to understand Simon Peter's circumstances here. He has been sentenced to death. The Lord has delivered him. It will not be long before the soldiers come looking for him. He knows that when they come looking for him, they will do so diligently, as if their life depends on it, because their lives do depend on it. Verse 19 is going to tell us that. So there's Simon Peter knocking on the door. She recognizes him. She runs away. And Simon Peter has just got to be out there absolutely sweating bullets right now. Like, are you kidding me? Everything I've been through. Days in the Roman prison, the Lord miraculously delivers me. And now Rhoda's going to get me killed. It's like, Lord, when you were putting this plan together, I hope you factored in the fact that Rhoda was going to be an airhead about this and, without opening the door, run to tell the disciples first. Verse 15, they said to her, who said this to her? The church that's meeting and praying for the deliverance of the apostle Peter. The church said to her, you are out of your mind. You might want to write ever-loving mind. That's actually the meaning in the original Greek. You are out of your ever-loving mind. No, that's not in the Greek, but it should have been. Rhoda, you're crazy. And I think that answers the question of how much faith was behind the church's prayer for Peter's deliverance. How much faith? I see none. Do you see any? I see none. They did not believe that God would do what they were asking God to do. Verse 5, sure, they were praying earnestly. They were sincere about their prayers. But that doesn't mean their prayers were filled with faith, does it? They sincerely wanted what they were asking the Lord for. Lord, be with the apostle Peter. Lord, help him through this time. Lord, deliver him from prison. Set him free. We need him. All of those prayers, they were praying earnestly with all of their hearts. But I see no evidence that there was faith behind this. Here's Christ's church praying their hearts out for days that the Lord would deliver the apostle Peter. Rhoda says he's out front. And the church says, Rhoda, you're crazy. You've lost your mind. It's disturbing how quick the disciples were to tell people that they were crazy. They did the same thing to Mary Magdalene. He's risen. I saw him. Mary Magdalene, you're out of your mind. Mary, mother of Mark, you're out of your mind. You're crazy. Man, I wish I could see this scene and everything that's going on. I wish I could hear their conversations. I just picture them in the room, you know, praying, oh, Lord Jesus, please deliver the apostle Peter. Lord, please set him free. Lord, we know that you can do this. What's that? Peter's out front. Shut up, you wacko. You're insane. Sure, we're praying for Peter's deliverance. We're church folk. That's what church folk do. We pray about stuff, but Rhoda, come on, you can't really expect the Lord to answer big prayers like this. Now quit being nonsensical, quit being a loon, and get back in here and help us pray for Simon Peter to be delivered. This passage is for Christians who have prayed for something so big that as you pray, you're thinking, there's no way the Lord's going to do that. Have you ever done that? You're praying for something so big and you feel in your heart, this is kind of dumb for me to even ask because this is not normal. This stuff doesn't happen. The Lord doesn't do big things like this. Not that I've seen. There's no way the Lord is going to do this. There's no way that the Lord is going to want to do this. There's no way that the Lord is going to follow through with this and actually answer my prayer. I have, to my own shame, I admit I have prayed that kind of way before. Twice. All right. No one believes that. More than twice. Okay. Quite a few times I've prayed that way before. Lord, I'm asking for this earnestly, sincerely. This is what I want, but I'm having trouble engaging my faith with this because it just seems so far out there that, Lord, even you wouldn't want to touch this. And so this story encourages me because it shows me that even when I'm praying without faith, it still counts to something for God. It still counts. The Lord still honors that prayer. Now, it is true, as the book of James teaches us, that if we aren't asking God in faith, then we can't suppose that we will receive anything. That's what James tells us. If you don't ask with faith, you can't suppose that you're going to receive from the Lord what you're asking. But that's just sort of pointing out the obvious, isn't it? Because what is faith? It's evidence and expectation. If I'm praying for something with faith, that means I am expecting God to do this. And if I'm praying without faith, then I am not expecting or supposing that God is going to answer that prayer. That's the very definition of faith as it attaches itself to prayer. But even if we find ourselves in a situation where we're praying without faith, can I encourage you to just still keep praying anyway? Because you never know if the Lord is going to answer that prayer. There's no rule in this book where the Lord says, if you don't have faith when you pray, I 100% guarantee you, I will not answer that prayer. No, James tells us, if you're praying without faith, you can't expect God to answer that prayer. That's true, but nowhere does God say, look, if you're not going to pray with faith, then just don't pray at all. I see quite the opposite. I see a church filled with people here that are praying for something, they're not believing for it, and guess what? The Lord did it anyway. So if you're praying faithlessly, keep praying. All the better if you look at the context of this teaching, because if you're praying in a group of people and you're praying for the same thing, you might not have faith for what you're praying for, but the person right beside you might. And that's enough to the Lord. And better yet, if you're on your own and you're not praying with a group and you're praying without faith, keep praying, because perhaps you might find your faith along the way. And it doesn't take much, does it? Jesus said, only faith the size of a little tiny mustard seed. That's all that is required for God to move mountains on your behalf. So keep praying, regardless of what it feels like. Regardless of if it feels like that it's powerful enough to actually move the hand of God, or if it feels dry and empty, prayer isn't about feeling. Prayer is about speaking with the Lord and inviting him and engaging him into that thing that you're praying for. So keep doing it. But the church in Jerusalem here, they weren't buying it. And they thought Rhoda had lost her mind. Reading on in verse 15, but she kept insisting that it was so. Guys, I'm telling you, I recognize that voice anywhere. That was the Apostle Peter. He's out front. I'm telling you guys, believe me. And they kept saying, it is his angel. What do they mean by that? Are they saying it's his ghost? Are they saying, well, Peter is obviously dead, and that's his ghost out front? No, that's not what they're saying. They don't think he's dead, or at least I don't think they do. One thing's for sure, they don't think it's his ghost. The word angel is correctly translated here. See, it was a Jewish belief that the Lord assigned guardian angels to each and every one of us to watch over us all of our lives. You can find biblical support for that. But the Jews took that a step further and they said, not only do we have guardian angels, but our guardian angels, if they want to, if necessary, they can take on our appearance and they can even mimic our vocal tones. So they can look like us and they can sound like us. Now that you won't find support for in the Bible. Could be true. Who knows? Maybe it's not true. Nonetheless, they really firmly believe that, and that's why they think that this is the Apostle Peter's angel. That seemed more believable to them. That seemed easier to believe than a simple, hey, we've been praying for this and God answered our prayer. So tougher to believe that we prayed and God answered, easier to believe that's the Apostle Peter's angel standing and knocking at the gate. And I have to ask, why would an angel even bother knocking? Angels never knock in the Bible. They never use doors. That's why one of the first things an angel is always going to say when they have an encounter with a person is, calm down, fear not, chill out. I know I didn't use the door. I know I broke in. I just dropped in on you, but calm down. Don't freak out. I have a message from the Lord, and I'll deliver that message, and I'll be on my way. And on top of that, if they really did believe this, then here's my question. Why didn't any of them want to go out and see the angel? You mean to tell me no one in that group could be disturbed to go out and have a conversation with an angel? I think if I thought there was an angel at the door, I'd want to go have a conversation with that angel. Now, I have a bunch of questions that I'm storing up for heaven, a bunch of questions that I plan on asking the Lord one day. But hey, if he sends me an angel, I think I'm fielding all those questions through that angel. He's going to leave exhausted. He's going to be like, man, that guy can beat your ear. I would want to see the angel. I would want to have a conversation with the angel. But the Jerusalem church, however, they would not allow themselves to be distracted from praying for Peter's release. Even Peter's actual release couldn't distract them from praying for Peter's release. Nothing was distracting the praying of this church, so I guess we got to give them credit for that. We got to give them credit for their prayer focus. That's a That's a tight focus. My praying is much more easily distracted than that. Dinner's ready, Lord. Can we table this, Lord? How about we reconvene after dinner? I'm much more easily distracted. This church could not be distracted from their praying. Verse 16. But Peter continued knocking, just like oy vey, this group. Guys, hello. Simon Peter out here. Would someone please open the door? I just love this picture. You know, God miraculously delivered him from Roman prison, and Peter can't even get himself into the prayer meeting that's being held specifically for him. Someone please let me in. So he's just knocking away. Maybe neighborhood dogs are barking and car alarms are going off. Would you guys open this door? You're going to get me killed. Peter continued knocking, and when they finally, I would add, opened, they saw him and were amazed. You might want to underline that word. They saw him and they were amazed. Prayed for it, never expected it, completely shocked that the Lord actually pulled it off. It is such a sad day when those most shocked about answered prayers are the ones praying them. Isn't that a terrible look on the church? We expect the unbelieving world to be shocked when God answers our prayers. We don't expect ourselves to be. But that's exactly what we see here in this chapter. Oh, us of little faith, may the Lord build our faith in the power of holy prayer. Verse 17. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, because you have to remember, they aren't inside the building. This is all happening at the gate there. They're like celebrating. Yes, it's Peter. I can't believe this. And so he has to shush them because this is still a dangerous situation. Reading on, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, probably in a hushed tone, tell these things to James. Now that would be not James the apostle, because Herod has killed him. He has martyred him, the first apostle to be martyred. He was with the Lord at this point. But this was James, the half-brother of Jesus, the guy that it seems would eventually become the senior pastor there at the church in Jerusalem. Also the author of the book of James. That's him. So tell James, tell these things to James and to the brothers. So these guys didn't come out to the gate, obviously. They were still inside. And clearly Peter isn't going inside. He's getting out of Dodge. He's giving this message to be passed along to the brothers that did not come outside. They probably sent all the women out, wouldn't you think? That's probably what these guys, lily-livered guys, did. Send the women out. They're less likely to kill them. And if they do, oh well. So then he, the Apostle Peter, departed and went to another place. So he is now in the Jesus Witness Protection Program. He dyed his hair, he trimmed his beard, moved to Maui, now goes by the name Petey, maybe. I don't know. We're going to see one more cameo of him in Acts chapter 15 for that council meeting, and then that's it for the biblical record of the Apostle Peter in the book of Acts. The book of Acts will not record anything further of his ministry. Was he still involved? Of course, to some degree. But his ministry from this time forward has to be secretive and guarded, because you have to understand there will always be a Roman death sentence hanging over his head. Now, the results of the end of this chapter isn't going to change that. Herod, the guy that gave that order, that made that sentence of execution, he's going to die at the end of this chapter. That's not going to change the fact that Simon Peter is a wanted man by the Roman government. So he's going to have to be quite a bit more careful about his ministry from this point forward. And it eventually will catch up to him. He ends up being crucified by the Romans for his faith in Jesus, though he was not crucified right side up. Church history tells us that he was sentenced to crucifixion, and he requested at his words that he not be crucified right side up, because he said, and I quote, I am not worthy to be I am not worthy to be slain as was my Lord. So upside down on the cross, Peter would eventually die. But that would be around 30 years from the writing of this verse, or pardon me, from the event of this verse. He would be what when he died? An old man. What do you know? Just as the Lord prophesied to him in John chapter 21, verse 18. The Lord told him, when you're an old man, you're going to stretch out your hands. That means when you're an old man, you're going to be crucified for your faith in me. And so he would be. Verse 18. Now, when day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. And I would have loved to hear them arguing about this. Like, are you kidding me? What do you mean it's my fault? You were chained to the guy. How are you sleeping so soundly that you let Simon Peter Houdini his way out of that? You were chained to the guy. I was just watching the door. Verse 17, verse 19. And after Herod searched for him and did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. Now, the Roman army abided by what is referred to as the Code of Justinian. And in matters like this, the Code of Justinian was very simple. If you were a Roman official and you were assigned to guarding a sentenced criminal, and that criminal escaped under your watch, then you, the Roman official, the Roman soldier, would suffer the sentence that was upon that criminal. Simon Peter, in his case, what is his sentence? It's a death sentence. It's execution. So now Herod has all of these soldiers executed for failing this assignment and allowing the Apostle Peter to escape. There were 16 soldiers assigned to this. And if they handled this security in shifts, which was pretty common for Romans to do, then that would probably mean that 4 soldiers were executed for Peter's escape. That would be the 2 guys chained to him and the 2 guys watching the door. But I don't want to rule out the possibility that this could very well be all 16 of these soldiers that were assigned to this responsibility were taken out and executed by Herod for failing their assignment. Fairly innocent men, if you really think about it. It wasn't their fault that Simon Peter was sentenced to death. He was innocent. It certainly wasn't their fault that Simon Peter escaped prison. The Lord did that. There wasn't anything or anyone on this earth that could have stopped that. So what was their only crime here? Their only crime really is working for the wrong boss. And as a result of that, standing in the way of the Lord, accomplishing his will. Our actions do have consequences. So in every life situation, you just have to know these 2 things. Don't work for the wrong boss and never get in the Lord's way. Now, don't be too quick to leave here and make that phone call and quit your job. You might want to pray about that a little bit first. But if you have a job or a boss that is forcing you to grieve the Lord on a regular basis, you are accountable for that. And I wouldn't want to have anything to do with that. I would at very least be looking feverishly for a new job. But I'll have to leave that to you. These guys, wrong place, wrong time, working for the wrong boss, find themselves in the way of the Lord accomplishing his will. Reading on in verse 19, then he, Herod Agrippa, went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. Honestly, I just don't think that Agrippa wanted to stick around Jerusalem and deal with the inevitable backlash that was going to follow. The fact that Simon Peter has once again escaped prison. This is now his 2nd prison escape. And I don't think Herod wants to deal with that at all. So he just wants to get out of there. And so he does. Verse 20. Now Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they came to him with one accord, and having persuaded Blastus, the king's chamberlain. Okay, now stop there real quick. A king's chamberlain was a servant to the king. That's what a chamberlain was, a servant to a king. So I think this guy Blastus has missed his calling in life. With a name like Blastus, I think he should have been a politician, because that's a perfect name for a politician, because that's what they do. They blast us with empty campaign promises. Then they get elected and they blast us with taxes. And then they blast us with regulations that make life miserable. So I really think this guy should have gone into politics. Perfect name for it. But anyway, I digress. Having persuaded Blastus, they ask for peace because their country depended on the king's country for food. Whatever it was that Tyre and Sidon did, it really upset Herod. And you couldn't afford to have Herod angry. Well, you don't want any of the Herods to be angry with you. And believe me, they were easily angered. Unfortunately for Tyre and Sidon, all of their food imports came from Herod. So you might put it like this. Herod was the hand that fed them. He was providing their food. You just don't want to get on the wrong side of a person like that. Good for them that they had this inn with the King Herod's closest man, his personal servant, Blastus. And that's always a wise move. You don't want to anger the people that are providing your food. This is why when I'm in a restaurant, I don't care how messed up the order is and how bad it is, I'm never, ever going to send it back with a complaint to the cook, because I just know it's going to come back to me with a loogie in it. That's how these things work. You don't anger the people that are providing your food. You keep them happy. And that's what they try to do here. Verse 21. On an appointed day, Herod Agrippa the First, put on his royal robes, took his seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. Verse 22. And the people were shouting, "The voice of a god and not a man." Now, the historian Josephus tells us that Herod's apparel on this day was woven out of tiny little strands of silver. My clothes are woven out of cotton, some poly, and some are a cotton poly blend. This guy's clothing on this day was woven out of silver threads. So you can imagine what that might look like in the glistening sun. He would be actually really tough to look at. Standing up there with all that metal on, the sun glistening off of him, he probably did look like a god up there. Clothing that would put Elton John to shame and make him look drab. And so he's kind of like trying to conjure up this image of greatness and perhaps even deity. But with that aside, you know what this crowd is doing, right? You know what Tyre and Sidon are doing, don't you? They are flattering him. He's their gravy train, so they are flattering him. It doesn't matter what he got up there and said. They're going to be like, "Wow, that was amazing." You know, he's probably up there like saying, "I'm the ruler. You're my servants. You'll obey my every word and anything he said." They're just like, "Wow, that was the best speech we've ever heard. That was amazing. Are you, tell me, Herod, are you a god? You must be a god. That was just amazing." And unfortunately for Herod, he gobbled that right up. He loved that flattery. He was just basking in that flattery. "Well, you know, I am the most incredible person I know, and I know a lot of people. You know, even though I'm used to all of my amazingness, there are times where I even amaze myself. That was a pretty good speech. Maybe you know what? I am a god, as a matter of fact." Verse 23, immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory. Agrippa got a grip of the glory and he would not let go. This was a man taking glory that only God should receive, and God wasn't all too pleased for it. And so the scripture goes on to say, he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Now, we don't question the scriptures here or anywhere. We believe that the angel showed up and immediately gave Herod worms. Boy, this is weird to talk about. I'm pretty sure this same angel has been visiting my dog Finley because he keeps having this problem too. But this angel shows up and he gives Herod worms, but his death does not happen instantly as you might think it did just based on reading verse 23. The historian Josephus tells us that it was 5 days after this oration that Herod Agrippa the First died. So the angel gives Herod worms right away, but it took five days for this to, you know, run its full course. And then the historian Josephus tells us that after 5 days, his intestines exploded due to a roundworm infestation. And these were a specific kind of roundworm. They were roundworm that were up to 16 inches in length. We aren't having spaghetti downstairs, are we? Because I might have ruined that for us. Nah, you'll be fine. Just try not to think about it. But this actually happened. You know, here's a situation where the Bible tells us one thing, and then a historian verifies it. Josephus wasn't a Christian. He was a Jew. He was an Orthodox Jew. He was not a Christian. He did not believe in Christ. And yet Josephus constantly confirms the biblical New Testament account. And Josephus tells us right here, sure enough, this did happen. 5 days after this oration, Herod, well, you know, and I won't say it again because we do have to eat. Verse 24. But the word of God increased and multiplied. So verses 23 and 24 are a contrast between those who try to rob God of his glory and those who refuse the glory that belongs only to the Lord and deflects that onto the Lord himself. Herod is dead, but the church grows and increases. Verse 25, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. So Mark is mentioned again here a second time. He actually returns to Antioch with Barnabas and Saul. That's what verse 25 told us. Again, this is Mark, the son of Mary, the Mary that was facilitating this prayer service. And we'll find out later that Mark and Barnabas are related, but we'll get to that later. Back to the main point here, verse 25 could seem inconsequential. You know, you need a closer verse, right? You got the meat of the chapter, and then just throw something at the end of the verse. This happened in chapter 11 too. You got the meat of the verse, and then at the end of the verse, Paul and Barnabas show up to Jerusalem with an offering for Jerusalem. End of the chapter, chapter 12, we need a closer verse. Just throw that on there. Paul and Barnabas leave Jerusalem. That's not inconsequential. Did you connect what happened here? Look at the last two verses of Acts chapter 11. Paul and Barnabas hand-delivered an offering to the believers there in Jerusalem from the believers in and around Antioch. So they show up at the end of chapter 11, and then all of chapter 12 happens. So Paul and Barnabas, or Saul and Barnabas, when we read now verse 25 of chapter 12, we see Paul and Barnabas leaving Jerusalem. That means Paul and Barnabas were in town for every bit of this. Everything that we've studied in chapter 12, Paul and Barnabas were there for that. They were in Jerusalem when the apostle James was martyred and the church was grieving that loss. Paul and Barnabas were in town when the apostle Peter was also captured and sentenced to death. It means that Paul and Barnabas were here for this prayer meeting for the release of the apostle Peter. It means that Paul and Barnabas were there when Rhoda runs in and says, Peter's outside at the gate. I didn't see him, but I heard him, so I just know it's him. It means that Paul and Barnabas were there when Peter himself is seen at the gate. They were there for all of this, and I just have to wonder, how might that have affected the rest of their lives and ministries? to know that the situation can be as hopeless as you can imagine. But if the Lord isn't done with you on this earth, then the only thing that's hopeless is trying to take you out before the Lord is done with you. How might that have given them boldness and confidence? Confidence that the Lord would be with them. Boldness that the Lord would supply for them and take care of them and rescue them when it was his plan to do so. And it's not only this, but it's events like this in the life of Paul that would eventually make its way to you and I through incredible doctrines about the sovereignty of God, about the power of God to answer our prayers, and about where it is that prayer is really situated in a battle. Let me give you two different verses from Paul. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds." How about this? Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." It is stuff like this, it's experiences like this that taught Paul that prayer isn't just like a passive little conversation with God, but that prayer is actually a way to fight our battles. And that whatever it is that we could do in the flesh to positively affect those battles, the fact is there's a whole realm of that that we can't touch except but by prayer. And that when we pray, we are, as I said earlier, inviting God into that battle with us. We are turning the Lord loose in that situation, and now he's going to be able to do way more than you could do or I could do. Worship team, you can come on up. Why is this so difficult for us to grasp? That prayer isn't just our communication line to the Lord. It is our most powerful weapon in the Christian faith. I could spend hours up here, and I know you believe me. I could spend hours up here telling you stories of situations that I got myself into or that my kids got me into, where I knew there was nothing I could do. Situations that involved changing another person's heart. Situations that involved a legal process that was out of my hands and in the hands of a secular-minded judge. Situations where it wasn't up to me, but it was up to the school board. All sorts of things out of my hands. And in those moments of helplessness, I not resorted to as a last measure, but I turned to prayer and I prayed. And in every one of those situations, I can tell you, the Lord blew my mind. I can't change a person's heart. I can't say anything when a judge is making a decision. I mean, I can raise my gripes against the school board, but I can't change what the school board says. But the Lord can do all of that just like this. He holds the Lord holds the king's hearts in his hands. He sets rulers in place. He can manipulate them. He can dethrone them if he needs to and set up another. That's what the scriptures teach us. Why is that so tough for us to get down? Why is prayer like the last resort? Why is it the thing we turn to last when we've expended every other avenue of help? Why is that last? Why is that, oh, man, I wish I could do more for you. All I can do is pray. No, that's the best thing we can do. Do you have a prayer need? The best thing you can do is pray. Are you in a battle? The best thing you can do is pray. Is life good? The best thing you can do is pray. Because tomorrow, life might not be good. I hope this story has just kickstarted once again that faith in our hearts for prayer. Just pray, church, just pray. Doesn't matter how you feel, what you think. Don't try to measure your faith. Do I have faith? Am I really believing the Lord? Don't bother with any of that. Just pray. Would you stand with me? And guess what? We're going to go to prayer. So what is it that you need to pray about today? A challenge, a temptation, a bondage, a battle. Stop trying and let the Lord have it. Talk to the Lord about it this morning. Let him have it. I think you'll be way happier with the outcome that he produces as opposed to the outcome that you were going to produce without him.